Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hernaday.
Hey, Ben. Hey friends. Cole.
Nicole Lamb. And Chris Casso.
Hello.
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 How are you? We're cold. Cole's put his coat on.
I'm cold.
I'm a little chilled. Yeah,
and but we're the Coles.
We are the Coles, and we are freezing our butts off.
The chili Coles.
The chili Coles.
All right.
Because it's a chilly start of a new year.
It is. It is. It is kind of a chilly start to the new year. Welcome to the new year. This is episode 151, dropping on January 1st. 2018.
Whoa.
I'm still writing 2017 on my checks.
Yep,
so if you can believe it.
Yep,
and
you
also made this
June.
Joke last year.
I think I've made this joke every year.
It's
yes.
Wonderful.
You know, it's comforting. It's something we can fall back on.
It's my New Year joke.
Love it.
All right. So, and if you're waiting for the recording of our live show, that may drop sometime in the next couple of weeks. I don't know exactly when, but stay tuned. We have a great interview with Kazuki Biwishi. But let's get on with today's show. Now, one of the pieces of feedback I've gotten about the podcast is that we seem to focus a lot on the major publishers, Marvel and DC. Hmm. Now, I would actually counter that and say we talk about every publisher. Maybe some of the news stories are primarily focused on Marvel and DC because that's the kind of news that gets into our radar. Because
they're the ones that are constantly pissing us off.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's not like I'm like, oh, NBM, you bastards.
They're not learning anything.
Image!
Fantagraphics!
But anyway.
How could you produce such good material? I'm so mad!
So in this brand new episode for this brand new year, that is the very last time I am going to mention the names Marvel and DC, and let's make this episode all about independent comics.
Oh, for the episode. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I was like, this whole year? Wow.
Oh,
this
that
is
would
gonna
be
interesting.
Welcome to the last episode of the year. Yeah. I'm sorry. I should have made that more clear. This is, yeah, I saw the look on your face. I'm like, maybe we'll figure this out. All right. So, yeah, let's just talk about independent comics, and let's focus on that. My first question to all of you is that are there different tiers of publishing companies? Like Marvel and DC will be at the top, right?
Mm-hmm.
And self-publishers who like print their own zines at home. Maybe zines isn't the right word, but print their own comics on their color laser printers that their parents bought them are at the bottom of the list. Is there just one middle ground, or are there like top tier indie comics versus lower tier indie comics, sort of like?
So one way to look at it is the preview catalog, which is the catalog that all comic stores order from, is organized in a certain way.
Yep.
And there's the front of the book and the back of the book. And the front of the book is the, what would you call the top tier? And those are just the big money guys. Mm-hmm. And it's alphabetical. It's Dark Horse, DC, IDW, Image, and then Marvel. And then everybody else is grouped together after that.
Okay.
So that's one way to perceive it.
I think. Dark Horse, IDW, and Image are on the same level as DC and Marvel?
As far as...
like publishing? When I say level, I mean like publishing influence.
You'd have to look at
their
like...
main...
yeah.
I guess you could call them mainstream, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, IDW would be the least mainstream of them all, but they deal with licensed material.
Right.
That's mainstream. To me, the moment you do licensed material, you're kind of mainstream.
Yeah.
The moment you touch a franchise.
Yeah.
And Dark Horse is all about that because of Aliens and Buffy and Predator and Terminator and video game known to man.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, but you get some like, so Titan Press, they do a lot of licensing and a lot of franchise stuff, but they're the back of the catalog. They're just not that big of a publisher in comparison to some of the others.
Well, and even Valiant is in
the back of the catalog, but they're superheroes.
Yep.
So if you define superheroes as mainstream, then Valiant is mainstream, but they're a much smaller company.
Yeah.
And then we already had to talk about like what's alternative versus indie,
right?
And both all that stuff ends up kind of in the back of the catalog. So
and then you have imports and you have European things and manga, and those are all done by different publishers as well.
Yeah. So I mean, you can say some of like the manga publishers, like Kodansha, is technically of smaller scale by the way we perceive things in America, but Kodansha has a lot of stuff, so they're not small scale.
Yeah, if you look at their website, it just goes on and on and on and on.
So they would be considered mainstream in Japan?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I would assume so. I think there's a Kodansha Marvel something.
Interesting.
I think they have an office over there that deals with it. I don't know.
There's also Yen Press.
Yeah.
But I don't know how big they are. Yeah, Viz. Tokyo Pop is coming back.
Mm-hmm. And Seven Seas.
Seven Seas Entertainment also does a lot of manga.
Yeah.
Of course, manga.
But then, like, and so there's an interesting scale of, like, so I was doing some research, and NBM, who published a book I reviewed last episode called Satania, they are one of the oldest graphic novel publishers in North America, established in 1976. They became NBM in 1984, but they are known as the second largest indie comics press after Fantagraphics, with close to $3 million in yearly retail sales on over 200,000 graphic novels sold a year, plus tens of thousands of comic books and magazines. So it's like, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
That but they're definitely big. A small presence in the previous catalog.
Yeah.
So it's, again, the perception versus the numbers, you know, that to me, that's massive compared to there's a new local publisher called Space Goat, and they're doing some licensing material. They got Evil Dead and The Howling. So that puts them in my mind like, oh, you're a little bit bigger because you've got those. But they definitely have a much smaller offering than somebody like NBM or Fantagraphics.
Yeah.
Right.
It's an interesting way you can look at it. Like, how much do they have to offer? How high are their print runs? What are their general sales looking like?
Versus the quality of their printing.
How much of the pie are they taking up financially?
How many people do they employ?
There's a lot of filters that you can put on this, and you can make anybody look more favorable with those filters.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, there's no great, just like quick, easy tier system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, because when we talk about comics as like mainstream comics versus indie comics, I don't really differentiate those because I come into the store and they're all on, you know, it's not like there's a mainstream section and an indie section. It's kind of all like for me, you know, it's kind of all like it's all here.
Yeah. It's all comics.
Yeah, it's all comics.
And that's how we like to have our new arrival display wall. It holds over 250 books a week, and it's all alphabetical.
Yep.
You all bow to the alphabet.
Yes.
And so you get some weird matches. Sometimes you get Mickey Mouse next to Neonomicon, and sometimes you get My Little Pony next to My Favorite Thing is Monsters, which is great.
Or My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness.
Yeah. So, you know, I got Barbarella right next to Batgirl right now. So, you know, there's a range right there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I like to, how to do it, because it forces people to see more things that might not be in their wheelhouse.
Exactly.
Yeah. They have to scan to try to find their thing, and they might come across something different.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. So, yeah.
Cool. Are there any lesser known publishers out there that, like, aside from like Valiant and Boom and Oni Press, the titles that we've talked about, NBM is a new one that I actually hadn't heard of them. Are there any others that we should tell people about?
Quite a few. I've got a couple notes here, and my entire quiz time is dedicated to it, so there will be a back end section. Drawn and Quarterly is always worth mentioning. They specialize in underground and alternative comics, but they also do classic reprints and translations of foreign works. They are known for publishing a lot of work by Linda Barry and Chris Ware, Chester Brown, Daniel Close, Joe Sacco, so like Palestine, that kind of stuff, and Kate Beaton, one of my favorites.
Hark of Vagrant.
Also, it's worth mentioning Top Shelf. They started in 1997, but they were bought out, and they are now an imprint of IDW. But a lot of stuff from Top Shelf includes like Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent's self-published works, Craig Thompson, James Kolchaka and all his weirdness, and Jeffrey Brown. There's always Jeffrey Brown and Chester Brown, and I always start to forget which one is which.
Very different.
Very different humans.
Yeah.
But Alan Moore does a lot from Top Shelf as well. And they do a lot of kids stuff next to Alan Moore stuff. So good range there.
Speaking of nothing, I couldn't remember Jeff Lemire's name last night. I was watching TV, and I was watching this political analyst talk on the TV, and his name is Jonathan Lemire. He writes for AP, and I'm like, wait a minute, is that the comic book guy? What's he doing shilling for AP on MSNBC? Anyway, go on.
It's always worth mentioning Boom. Boom and Arkea, they merged a little while back.
Yep.
I think Arkea merged into Boom.
I think so. I think Boom owns Arkea.
And Boom is, they do a lot of great work, but they also do a lot of licensed stuff. They do a lot of the Jim Henson stuff through Arkea.
And they also do TV things. They do Adventure Time. They do Clarence. Yep. They do all kinds of stuff I can't think of. Steven Universe.
They do a lot of great kids books, but a lot of what I would call millennial books, which is stuff like
Teen Dog
and stuff like Being Puppy Cat. A certain art style that, you know, if you think of Adventure Time and Steven Universe, those are what I imagine to be millennial books.
There's also a small publishing house called Nobrow, and they've done things like Hilda and the Troll, which is a great all-age series. There's a book that I'm going to be reviewing later called Pantheon, and they tend to have some really interesting things from time to time. I think
The one I can't order anymore.
The
about
Night
the
Lights
little girl.
Book Nightlight was book? Really yeah. beautiful. So every once in a while, they'll have something really cool that they come out with.
We started ordering directly from Silver Sprocket.
Oh yes,
and they do Catboy, and they do what is the one that you're going to take home and read about the?
Oh, that I already read. I think it's a Keep Warm collection.
Yeah.
I think it's called This Is the Place or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it caters to kind of more the zine punk rock aspect of comic books, but not completely. But they've done a lot of being in a punk rock band. Liz Prince has done stuff there.
She just got a new book.
She did one Be Your Own Backup Band. So if you kind of like the punk rock thing, it can be really fun. The Keep Warm collection has tons of hardcore references, and it's really kind of specific, kind of like Lovable Oaf was to me as well, music wise. And a lot of the humor does tend to be a little bit more millennial as well, which just means that it has references that people of that age would get, and especially if you're in a particular spot.
When it comes to price points, are indie comics generally more expensive, cheaper than mainstream?
They vary, but I find that they're roughly pretty reasonably priced. I mean, I think if you're going to look at the higher end with Marvel, where they'll have a tiny hardcover for $50, you'll get much better quality material for less, I think, from a lot of these places. But they do vary, because it's up to them to decide what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And back to you, Chris.
Another one that we order directly from is Microcosm. They're in Portland, Oregon, I think. And they're interesting because they do a lot of stuff that we're finding useful to hand off to educators. And some of it is kind of history book stuff. There's Teenage Rebels, the successful high school activist from Little Rock 9 to the Class of Tomorrow. Threadbare is another one that we've been pushing. It's the connections between the global fashion and sex trades. They're very interesting, kind of some politically spiced books. I cannot talk today.
Mm-hmm. There's also Make a Zine, too.
Yeah, Make a Zine.
Things like that, and Guide to Portland.
There's one that's a kind of an autobiography about growing up Cuban, gay, and punk in Florida. No, I can't remember where.
I can't remember where.
So some interesting newer publishers there, worth mentioning. So, yeah.
So, Cole, as a lifelong collector of comics, do you pay attention to who the publisher is at all when you're interested in a book? That's too mainstream for me. I can't read that.
No. No. I listen to these guys. I have to watch my pennies anymore.
Yeah.
And, if I kind of have this rule of thumb that if it's a book that these guys, that touches on my taste, that these guys get excited about, I will go home and I will A, either try and get it from the library, or B, I will do silly things like I'm going to go back to square one and get the first issue and try to catch up.
Right.
I made a note to myself the last episode that I need to read Super Sons because Nicole got really excited about it. It was one of her favorite books, and I always kept blowing it off, and I actually just went to eBay and made a watch on a bunch of first issues. Yeah, I could get them in graphic novel in collected form.
It might be available through the library. Things like the Teen Titans that Damien's in, that's available through the library, and that could be a good way to
But the Super Sons series in particular, you were excited about.
You could borrow my issues. Look, I want you to read it.
I don't need to borrow your issues.
It.
I got enough issues of my own. I actually trust your taste that if that's something you enjoy, I will go and, you know, I'll get the first six probably.
Give it a try.
When I get some monies, and I will probably enjoy it. If I don't, then I'll just read the graphic novels from the library.
Yeah.
Or I should say trades, I'm sorry.
So it's not a collect, but it's a read, like kind of scenario, right?
Yeah, but you know, there are some times where it's like I was a little late catching that train, like with Black Hammer.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how much I enjoy Black Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. Unfortunately, I got to watch my panties.
And there's so much out there.
I don't have a lot of room anymore.
Yeah, room. There's a lot coming out.
Remember, that was the big deal in 2017 was Cole like getting rid of the guest bed so he could shift the book boxes around. And I'm still working on that project. And that will probably be the project. So I don't know if that answers your question, Ben.
It doesn't matter. Just wanted to get you to say something.
Okay. All right. And guess what?
Questions anyway.
Anyway, I've always had this preconceived notion. Before we started this whole podcasting 151 episodes ago.
Great.
50 years ago.
I had this notion that mainstream comics were superheroes and indie comics were comics about the human experience. And
that's not entirely wrong.
Probably some truth to that, but of course, you know, you do have indie comics that have superhero stories and mainstream comics that do have stories about the human experience or licensed properties. Marvel has the Stephen King books.
Right.
When you have Ms. Marvel that does the human experience and superheroes.
Exactly. And a nice blend of the two.
Yes.
All right, cool. And I did look into some news stories from indie comics, and one thing is the Boom Studios marketing exec left. Who cares about that? I thought it was going to be a thing because it was like, oh, he left rather suddenly. Nobody knows why, but he's probably just getting burned out. Anyway.
Got a better paying job.
I know, probably. But the other thing is Lionforge has announced it's going to be releasing a comics anthology titled Puerto Rico Strong, which 100% of the profits will go entirely to aiding Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. And so that's actually a really great thing because if you pay attention to the news, we're not doing a lot.
From this
perspective of helping Puerto Rico get back
on their
feet.
And they are one of our territories, and they are our people.
Yeah. So
there's a whole lot of political red tape around that stuff. If you look into it, you can check our political podcast that's after this. No,
exactly.
But right. So
also called We Have Issues.
We have issues. Yes.
So Lionforge is doing that, and that reminded me of another. Comic anthology that was the benefits were going towards
Love is Love.
Love is Love. Thank you. I was trying to remember it.
Yeah.
And so there's some. And who published that? Was that?
That was IDW. And all the proceeds went to the Pulse nightclub shooting victims.
It was
and
a joint between IDW and DC.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that did really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was.
That was one of our best sellers throughout the last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was very beautiful, very moving. There's a lot of great stories in there.
Didn't Scott review that?
Yeah, and he said did. if you have a dry eye, like you don't have a soul or something along those lines. So that was really good. And I gotta say, Lionforge is really hitting it out of the park because they're hitting all kinds of ways. Like they are doing a superhero line, they're doing some kids stuff, but they're bringing in a lot of import material. Like I thought they were just going to be like another kind of small publisher, but I feel like they're a heavy hitter. I think they're probably somebody to look to for 2018.
Okay.
Well, they got some backing behind them too.
Oh, they've got to with everything that they're pulling. So this is really wonderful that they're doing this, and it's totally in line with their brand and their mission. So I think that's wonderful.
Great. Alrighty. Well, thank you for that. It's certainly a learning experience for me to learn what constitutes the indie comic scene and how it separates itself from the mainstream comics. And let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And I said, all indie titles, please. And so show me what you got. Let's start with Chris.
Show
me what you got.
This is Kodansha. This is something that Nicole talked about previously. She reviewed another book by the creator on our last episode.
Yes.
And we both chose this as one of our top five books of the year.
Yes.
This also just came in like 2 weeks ago.
A few weeks.
3 weeks. 4 weeks by podcast time.
By podcast time, we have number two in our grubby little hands.
Gotcha. So, To Your Eternity by Yoshitoki Oima. It is a fascinating setup. Basically, a unidentified person, something, puts a orb onto the planet, and it observes, and it turns into a rock. And then eventually, a injured wolf goes by it, and it turns into a copy of the wolf. And it begins to just kind of wander, and it comes across like this small fishing village, and there's like a boy there by himself, and it turns out like everybody else is dead and gone, and he's by himself, and he is like horribly optimistic, like about everything.
Yep.
Even though like I don't think this is going to turn out good for him, and so the creature, the orb, who is now a wolf, is just kind of learning stuff from the kid, just kind of watching him, and the kid thinks that this is his old pet wolf. He doesn't know anything different about it, and I don't want to spoil some of the stuff that happens with that, but the story eventually flips over into following this small village that apparently they have to choose a young girl who's been untouched to sacrifice to a god every cycle, and they're forced to do it. There's a enforcer from like a larger city or something that is keeping an eye and making sure that the sacrifice doesn't run away. And the two stories do eventually overlap. I don't want to spoil too much of that. But it is fascinatingly put together, great writing, and I really love her artwork. She has some amazing line work and some great detail, a great sense of action and emoting with her characters. So it instantly became one of my new favorites. And it also features this really kind of derpy dog that it turns out it can talk, and it goes like, thank you. And it's kind of great just because of that wolf.
But don't be thrown off by the word derpy. It is very much an emotionally what would you say,
devastating
in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But it's also the depth of character that she's able to do, and the emoting that she does through her art is just something that is so spectacular. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about the orb is that it really knows absolutely nothing. It has no context of Earth or wherever they are.
And when it takes a physical form, it doesn't know how to eat.
It doesn't know how to do anything.
Yeah.
It will die again and again and again, you know, just to try to learn things.
Yeah. And there's a sequence where it takes a human form and it doesn't know that you defecate. And it ends up just kind of walking around with all of its extra stuff. And so stuff like that. It's
very really interesting.
And it makes you just really wonder, like, where is it going?
Yes.
Will it go somewhere? But it not in a horrible Lost way.
More in an intriguing, like, do tell me more.
Yes.
I'm really invested in the world. I mean, one volume, I think you're hooked. I mean, you get halfway through it and I think you're hooked.
Mm-hmm. And it's not too pricey. It is, how much is it, Cole?
$12.99.
That's for a really good read.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Very good. Yep.
All right. Cool. To Your Eternity. Thank you, Chris. Nicole, let's move on to you. What do you want to tell us about?
I hope you don't mind. I interjected like
That's
so
okay.
hard because I really love that series. Obviously,
we got to push it.
No, it's great.
Yes, please special order. No Brow, which I talked about earlier, they made this book called they published this book called Pantheon: The True Story of the Egyptian Deities by Hamish Steele, and this goes through the wackiness that is Egyptian mythology in a very cartoony way.
It's funny because when I think of Egyptian mythology, I don't really think wacky.
Yeah, well, I learned some things. I love Egypt. That's my favorite ancient civilization of all time. But I still don't know a ton of it. So, I mean, even just their idea of how the world was made is really interesting. There's, you know, just there's a lotus, and then out of the lotus comes the sun, and then out of the sun. That's the first day. And then there's like this big fat god guy and he, you know, sits around bored. A lot of gods are very bored. And then they decide to like make a bunch of things in their image. And there's humans and there's gods and they all live together and it's kind of an Eden. But then everybody's like super, super bored because that's apparently just why things change and get awful. Then you get like this interesting cast of characters of all of the different children pretty much of the god. You know, God becomes like Ra, which is the sun god. They create turbulence with the humans by slaughtering a lot of them. And it's just I don't even know if I want to talk about all of it, but they make people really wacky. There's a lot of humor. It's pretty crass. There's a lot of cursing, but it is so very entertaining. Like, I sat down and I read this all in one sitting, and I couldn't get enough of it. I was laughing hysterically, and I learned so much from it. There's even a section in the center that's how to mummify your friends with Anubis, and it goes through all the different things that they do. So again, very informative, very weird. There's like golden phallic objects and poison seeds, that's all I'm gonna say, and just like the things that I can't show on this podcast.
It looks like a pretty easy read. It's got a
super easy to read,
cartoony style,
very cartoony, simple. I love the coloring on it. I get such a kick out of this thing. That's why it was one of my favorite books of the year. And I feel like I could reread it again and again, even though it's so simple and I probably would memorize everything. I just think it's delightful.
And that cover has one god kicking another god in the nards, which instantly makes it better than Hickman's God is Dead.
Right?
So, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's just fun. I kind of wish that this could be something that could be in a school. Like, I know because we're a nonprofit, we think about these kinds of things. Right. I know I do. But it's like so crass and so so vulgar.
Kids would love it.
Like Chris was mentioning, it may be something in college if you were doing some weird theology, mythology, something. Mm-hmm. I don't know what people study in college. I didn't do that. Anyway, it's so much fun. And it's from Nobrow. You might be able to order it directly from them, which I would definitely recommend.
Nobrow.
Nobrow.
I was looking at that for the whole show, and I thought, oh, Nobro.
You knob. It's Nobrow.
It's so it's a $23 book. It's kind of chunky. It's like short and stout and delightful.
Like me.
Yeah. It's a cute little shorty. And I highly recommend it. If you like any of that stuff or you just like just ridiculous humor or gods kicking each other in the nards, please pick this book
All
up.
All right.
Pantheon.
Pantheon by Nobrow. Thank you, Nicole.
Well, I kind of screwed up. I kind of flip-flopped. The independent book that I was going to review for our independent corner, I did last week.
Cole Hornaday, you are fired.
Oh, yeah, because it was a book I picked up at the Short Run Festival. But I'm kind of moving into my research process for the next episode of The Panel Jumper, and this one's going to be about Jack Kirby and Roger Zelazny's Lord of Light and the attempt to make it into a movie. Kind of a little bit of a segue. You want to read another kind of interesting book on the that deals with the Egyptian pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
The next episode of The Panel Jumper is going to be about space gods and Kirby's and space gods relating to the Kirby stuff. But also Zelazny, you know, took god pantheons and pantheons of gods, ancient pantheons, and cast them into kind of a science fiction context. And he did one that inspired the whole Lord of Light film, and of course it's called Lord of Light, deals with the Southeast Asian or Indian gods, Sanskrit gods of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. But he also did a book pertaining to Egyptian pantheon called Creatures of Light and Darkness that it's basically, you kind of forget that you're dealing with Egyptian gods because they're not always dropping their names, mm-hmm. but it's all these epic space god battles.
Well, and some of the gods are also other gods that are the same gods.
And it gets a little confusing.
So it gets a little confusing.
It's not a particularly thick book. It's like 129, 150 pages. And I got a little lost, but yeah, there's no flowchart.
There's a family tree in Pantheon.
But you were saying that like I'd like to learn more, and that book you might get a kick out of.
I probably will.
Anyway, on to my book report. sorry.
It's a teaching moment.
So I picked up a book that I've wanted to read for a long time. It's Mark Evanier's Kirby, the King of Comics. It's his biography of Jack Kirby. And of all the people in the world to write a biography on Jack Kirby, Mark Evanier is the one, because he was Kirby's assistant when he was a young man. And this book was published in 2008, and the story I've heard is that Evanier actually has will be writing an even lengthier biography on Kirby, because he has all of the Kirby estate documentation. He's got all the letters. He's got access to all the original artwork. He has apparently hours and hours of interviews he did with Jack. And this book itself is a lovely, lovely, lovely tribute to the arc of Kirby's life. Because one of the things you need to remember is that Kirby didn't do it all by himself. And though he established a lot of the visual storytelling language because he was there from the ground, you know, he was doing newspaper strips. He was there when that transition happened into comic books. He and Joe Simon were the two men, along with Will Eisner, who established the visual storytelling language that we use now. And as a creative force, he also evolved, and he had a greater, his imagination was of a greater magnitude than we could really appreciate at his time, at the time of his death, when he was experimenting with these space god stories, like, you know, the fourth world and the Eternals and all that lovely stuff. The book is a fair tribute. It's a lovely tribute. It reminds us, but it just barely scratches the surface of what this man could do. So one of the things that's really cool about the book is that there's artwork that you're probably going to not sketch, strips that you're probably not going to see in a lot of other stuff. You know, his early Captain America stories he did with Joe Simon, the Young Allies and the Boy Commandos, and there are lovely excerpts. But one of the coolest things about the book is that in 1983, publisher of Argosy magazine asked Jack to do a biographical piece, and he did. It's called Street Code, but it was all printed from his pencils. Nothing is inked. So it's that 1983. It's that later light. Period of his life, storytelling style, with big explosive images, but it's a very intimate autobiographical story about growing up on the streets of New York, all done in pencil and all just about as lovingly reproduced as it could possibly be in this book. And it's marvelous. And you get some wonderful insight into what his creative process was like. This is a great book. I had a lot of fun reading it. It taught me a lot. It also reminded me why this man was so brilliant. There's a moment that I was really proud of in our last Panel Jumper episode. A little bit I wrote that lifted from Shakespeare, where I talked about how comics, like all art forms, hold a mirror up to nature. I was kind of proud of that bit. But then there's this great quote in the book. I'm going to try and find it. Where a librarian asked Jack Kirby, his head librarian, it was after an art show, gallery show, showing Jack's artwork and other comic book creators. And she said the head librarian turned to the man next to her, who happened to be Jack Kirby, and asked him if he thought that comics mirrored reality. Jack said, no, comics transcend reality. And the answer startled the librarian. She said, well, if you were, and she said, if you were a mirror to if you were to mirror reality, then perhaps others could begin to understand it. Jack popped a piece of cheddar cheese into his mouth, fixed her with his Jack Kirby stare, and said, "Madam," he said, "when you mirror reality, you see it backward. When you start transcending it, that's when you have a real good shot figuring out what's going on." And I was like, wow, that is the best. And I thought I was so Shakespearean and so clever with my closing bit of the panel jumper episode, and I can't freaking hold the candle to Jack Kirby's analysis of why comic books are so vital. Great book. If you can find a copy of it, I seriously doubt it's in print, but I got it at the local public library.
Who published it?
It was published by
Abrams. I looked it up.
So yeah. That's not Marvel on DC.
You're right.
You still made it.
All right. Thank you. Because it does.
All
it
right.
Does,
you're not fired.
It does. It does encompass all of his work. And, you know, here it is. There's a great, it's full of lots of great quotes and stuff, but there's one from Michael Chabon, who wrote The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and he said, "I don't think it's any accident that at this point in their history, the entire Marvel universe and the entire DC universe are now all pinned or rooted on Kirby concepts."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about an amazing legacy right there. He nailed it.
By the way, the soft cover is available at your local comic book store for $25.
Hurrah! Alrighty. I recommend it.
Cool. All right. Kirby, King of Comics. Kirby, thank you, King Cole Hornaday. Well, that is Book Apart, and that is our show, but coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Subscribe to the podcast that on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Chris Casso. Lay it on us.
This is all about comic book publishers. All
right.
So,
almost like there's a theme today.
I know, right? Okay. Formed in 1999 by a group of entertainment executives and artists, IDW's goal was to develop products related to video games, movies, TV, collectible card games, comic books, and trading cards. In 2000, IDW formed its publishing division, IDW Publishing, and in 2007, IDT, International Discount Telecommunications, purchased a majority interest in IDW. IDW Publishing's first traditional comic series, 30 Days of Night, started a seven-figure bidding war between DreamWorks, MGM, and Senator International. And later on, they would finally start picking up more comic books, and mostly based on TV franchises, and eventually a lot of Hasbro's creative properties. What does IDW stand for?
Oh my God, I want to say something so dirty, but I'm not going to.
Oh, okay.
Is it like ideas, dreams, and words?
Close.
Yeah.
That's nice. One third. I like that.
Yeah, that is good.
Okay.
Idea and Design Works.
Ah.
Yeah. And that's both the parent company and the comic punk company.
Because I looked it up once too, because I'm like, oh, what does that stand for?
I know, yeah.
And with my crummy retention, guess what?
Oni Press was founded in 1997 by Bob Schreck and Joe Nosemack, with the goal of publishing comics and graphic novels that they would want to read. Oni used the term real mainstream, coined by Stephen Holland of the UK comic shop Page 45, to suggest that the subject matter it publishes is more in line with popular genres of other media, such as thrillers, romances, and realistic drama. For the most part, Oni Press avoids publishing superhero titles unless they're interesting approaches to the concepts. In 2016, Oni launched a new imprint. What is it called?
Limerous Press.
Mm-hmm. Limerous Press, an imprint for erotic and sex education comics.
Of course, that's why Nicole knows it.
Yeah. Focused on positive, diverse, and approachable stories that reflect a wide variety of emotional and intimate experiences.
They only have 2 books out, though.
I know, they're taking forever. Designed as a new infrastructure to support comic book creators and a new pipeline for transgressive art, Black Mass Studios was formed by Matt Pizzolo, Steve Niles, and Brett Gurwitz in 2012. Niles noted that if V for Vendetta were created today, there would be no publisher for it. Pizzolo has explained that Black Mask will operate under the mottos "to create, you must destroy," and "inspire, never meddle." Their belief of bringing the punk rock ethic to comics and supporting creators telling awesome and important stories have led them to publish books tackling a wide range of socio-political topics, ranging from civil rights, LGBT topics, and animal rights. What was the first comic under their publishing house?
Was it Liberators?
Nope. Close.
Their first comic?
Mm-hmm. It made a big splash because it featured Art Spiegelman.
Wow, I don't think I know that.
June 12, 2012, they opened its web store and officially released Occupy Comics.
Really? Hmm. I thought Liberators came out before Occupy.
The first one I could find on the thing. Featuring Pulitzer Prize winner Art Spiegelman and Jimmy Palmiotti, Matt Bowers, Bill Ayers, and a whole bunch of other people.
Alan Moore did a something in there, too.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, launching in May of 2006, First Second Press is home to a wide variety of all-ages books that cover any imaginable genre and are hands down one of the best publishers of educational comics today. That's me saying that right now. From their website, First Second will consider original graphic novel projects in almost any genre for any age, fiction of all kinds and nonfiction, from visual essays to journalism and memoirs. Although not all of our titles may be suitable to young readers, we do not publish pornography or books with gratuitous violence. We're interested in authors with a unique and sincere voice. The books we love best leave us in a generative place. What is the meaning of First Second's name? I never knew this until now.
First Second.
First Second. It's a science thing.
It's a science thing.
And their thing is usually semicolon 01.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Which
how
is
they do it.
A very specific reason why they do that. Okay.
Yeah, no.
It is a reference to the Big Bang, and their website focuses on a quote from Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. Here's a quick part of the quote, because it's like five times as big as this. The first second, imagine shrinking a proton down to a billionth of its normal size. Now pack it into that tiny, tiny space, about an ounce of matter. Bang, you are ready to start a universe. And so from nothing, our universe begins in a single blinding pulse, a moment of glory, much too swift and expansive for any form of words. The singularity assumes heavenly dimensions, space beyond consumption, in the first lively second, a second that many cosmologists will devote careers to shaving into ever finer wafers, is produced gravity and the other forces that govern physics. There's a lot more to that quote.
But what does that have to do with comics?
It's just the first second. Yeah,
they're creating the universe.
That's really great. I've never seen it written out. That's how dumb the English language is. Whenever anybody's ever said First Second Press, I've always thought like first, second, third, fourth, fifth.
And their website talks about that a bit. Mm-hmm. They're like, that's what the initial thing. But it's when you put the 01 in First Second, they're just talking about that first second of reality.
Mm.
Dang.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, whoa, okay. Last question. Based in Rantoul, Illinois, and founded in 1996 by William A. Christensen, Avatar Press is most notable for publishing bad girl comics, such as Pandora, Helena, The Lookers, The Ravening, and Brian Pulido's Lady Death. As part of an effort to expand beyond their reputation as a bad girl publisher, they've wrangled the likes of Frank Miller, Warren Ellis, Alan Moore, and Garth Ennis to publish creator-owned books. What sort of Faustian deals were cut, and or what type of blackmail content do you suppose was necessary to engage those talents?
Probably Mamon.
Yeah.
Like from Black Monday Murders.
Yeah, probably something
I
like that.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
My actual answer was just no content restrictions whatsoever is specifically stated on one of the websites.
Wow.
So if you make a creator-owned and you tell them, we will not edit you, they will come a-coming.
I bet.
Oh, yes. With all tentacles, right. they will come.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. Well, that is quiz time, and that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Woo-hoo!